People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
The day that I realized I didn't have a drug problem, that I had a Callum problem, was the day I was really able to start to do the underlining work on Callum.
For 5 years, I was out on the streets, homeless, and I struggled coming to the hospital because I never had anywhere to use.
If it wasn't for physicians that took a stand and took a risk, I wouldn't be here, and that would be pretty devastating to my two kids.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. You just heard sound bites recorded around a pop-up overdose prevention site just outside of the North Island Hospital, Comox Valley, on Monday, January 20th. The unsanctioned, unfunded site was set up by a group called Doctors for Safer Drug Policy. It's made up of physicians from around Vancouver Island who are calling for overdose prevention sites to be opened up at or near island hospitals. On today's program, we're going to be bringing you coverage of that site in the Comox Valley, including stories from people with experience recovering from addiction-related harms. Overdose prevention sites are places people can use substances under the supervision of trained staff that can monitor for drug poisoning and respond to an overdose if needed. In November, the same group, Doctors for Safer Drug Policy, opened up pop-up sites near hospitals in Nanaimo and Victoria. Spearheading the effort in the Comox Valley is Dr. Eva Hemerick. She runs and works at The Village Clinic in Courtney. It's the main opioid agonist therapy clinic in the community. After Island Health Security had taped off a grassy courtyard area in front of the hospital, the group relocated to the boulevard just off of hospital property, where they set up a tent. Hemerick addressed members of the media Monday morning as the site was being set up.
I'm part of an organization that started up called Doctors for Safer Drug Policy, and we are here in direct response to the government's stalled plans to roll out overdose prevention sites, or OPSs as we refer them to, through our province. It was actually promised to us in 2016 when our public health emergency with a toxic drug supply and six people dying a day still of overdose was mandated or encouraged, and we had three OPSs on the island that were going to start up and then were just stopped. And this spring, likely due to election political reasons, and so we are here to show that we need to have this done right now. We need an action from the government to roll this out because people are dying within the hospital grounds. Patients who use substances cannot use their substance in hospital. It's not allowed, so they're forced to go and use it in the bathroom, in the stairwells, in parking lot, in the forest, and overdose and die instead of receiving the treatment and being able to receive their substance that they need to use every 3 or 4 hours. Most people smoke their fentanyl in order to control the withdrawal, which is withdrawal that the public doesn't realize, I don't think, that withdrawal is like the worst flu imaginable. It's horrendous. And so the only way you get relief to even feel normal is to smoke your substance. So that's why people actually leave hospital. They leave, they don't get the care, and they get sicker. And so OPSs is an evidence-based measure that we know reduces overdoses. It connects people to care because it's staffed by people who are trained in overdose response, and connects them to care, referral to treatment, gives harm reduction supplies, and also it takes the pressure off nursing staff and other healthcare providers to having to deal with a sudden overdose, attending to that, or potential exposure to toxic, fumes or substances. So it's a win-win in this whole picture of tragedies and horrendous and unbelievable number of overdoses. I mean, it's the leading cause of death for anyone in BC that's between age 10 and 59. It's the number one reason why one of them would die. This is where we're at. So by addressing and taking care of this population in hospital, we know we can reduce those deaths. So it's basically a no-brainer, but we just need the government to mandate to roll them out.
How many doctors and health practitioners do you have out here today?
Probably. You see them across the street here. Yeah, look at them waving. There's seven of them and myself. Yeah, I mean, there's everybody supportive of this. They're just busy working and otherwise would be here as well.
How many OPSs were supposed to be rolled out when, let's say, put a halt on that?
Yeah,
there was... Or, sorry, where were they supposed to go?
There were supposed to be one in Nanaimo. And the Nanaimo at Victoria Jubilee and then later in Campbell River, three of them. Okay. And now they're just put on hold and there's no plans, says our premier, to roll them out at all.
Do all the doctors, you all practice and have...
We all practice addictions medicine.
Okay. And part of that's with the hospital or connection with the hospital?
Some are staffed by the hospital. Sure. Yeah.
How's that kind of a conflict, or how do you... I'm sure I have a health tech preventing it from being on there. How do you professionally kind of like juggle kind of...
It's a real challenge. It's a real challenge. Actually, we're looking at potentially one of the physicians are likely going to get fired for this involvement, which is unbelievable, abhorrible, really, that Island Health feels to silence in a way, but we feel so passionate. This is saving lives. It's saving costs, saving lives, and it goes above that. It's our code of ethics and, you know, Hippocrates' oath, you know, and what we swear by is to do no harm but to help people.
And what do you say to the public? Because I'm sure you've heard the objections. It's like all you're doing is kind of enabling drugs and all that kind of stuff. How do you kind of say that this is the safe way to do it and they're going to be doing drugs anyway?
Yes, and that is not correct because overdose prevention sites are proven to actually help people. We have a problem. We all have this problem. And this is a measure that reduces use, reduces costs, reduces infectious diseases. It unburdens our healthcare, you know, system, really, as opposed to the ID. I can see why it could be thought of it, but there's no truth or evidence behind it. So, and it's also giving people a safe place to use. The people we deal with and work with, it's heartbreaking. They're so stigmatized. And actually, the hospital is the last place they don't want to turn to because I've had so many bad experiences. We have to talk them into coming to hospital, and then we get heavy-hearted because then we see they left against medical advice, and we know it's because they had to use their medicine or their substance to function. And one other thing that's really important in our drug supply now, we have almost always benzodiazepines, which are tranquilizers that turn people into a little bit of zombies. You see people walking and they seem to be not at all in their state. And that's benzos in the fentanyl toxic drug supply. And what happens to that is that when you go into benzo withdrawal, you risk having seizures and even dying. So people cannot just stop using their substances. Opioids, they will feel horrible, but they can survive it. But adding the benzos is dangerous. They can die from it. So even if people say, why can't you stop using? And they can't. They have to go to a medical detox facility, which the closest one is in Clearview in Nanaimo, or they, and then, you know, ideally treatment. So they have, or in hospital, but we don't even have any detox beds here. So,
just touching on Gord's point there, like the science might be on your side, but it seems like the public opinion seems to be perhaps not completely on your side. How do you win over the public support?
Yeah, I think by telling people stories. I think everybody's heart at some point needs to be touched, whether it's a nephew or a neighbor, a co-worker. That basically we live in a society of addiction, really. You know, where's your smartphone right now? You know where it is. If you lost it, you panic. I mean, just in general, the whole, our brain chemistry is such, and we have a huge problem, and we need to all step in and do this together. And so I think just by explaining, educating, a lot of people can make judgments when they don't have the full story and realize the whole withdrawal symptoms. People don't realize, just like a cigarette smoker has to go for smoking breaks every 4 to 6 hours, a fentanyl user, otherwise they get irritable, anxious, and somebody smoking fentanyl, they have to, or they get really sick. Not anxious and, you know, irritable, they get terribly sick. So people don't know that. They don't have that education piece. So that's important to get it out there.
You talked about trying to change the mind of Island Health. What do you say to the health minister about this whole thing?
This is who we're talking to. The Minister of Health, Josie Osborne. Please, this is such an easy, evidence-based measure. Just please give it to patients. Poor their patients are already stigmatized, don't present until late into their conditions, and at least we can do is provide them with a safe place.
Have you spoken with the new minister yet? Or?
I haven't personally, but our main spokesperson for the organization, Dr. Wilder, has. Yeah.
And what's the plan for this site here in the Comox Valley this week? How long are you going to be here?
We plan to be here Monday through Friday, 10 to 6, and to be at functioning OPS, where we are taking turns for shifts, and people can come in and use it for smoking or IV injection. So we're hoping that inpatients will be able to use it rather than going across the bushes or in the bathroom unsupervised and risk overdose, that they will come here with the support and be able to help them access care and treatment, potentially referrals and such. And I deal with prescribing opioid agonist therapy, which is an opioid replacement. So connecting them with care and giving them hope and making them feel cared for.
So you're planning on staying set up here for a period of time?
Yes.
How big of a problem is this in the Comox Valley? And I don't know if you could mention how many patients you're dealing with this.
It's a huge problem.
Yeah.
And it's what we see in our clinic. I work for the, at the main OAT outpatient addictions clinic in town. It's called the Village Clinic on 5th Street. And we started with a few half days, and now we could easily have 5 days a week. The problem is just growing, but still there's so much stigma that we're not seeing we're seeing a fraction of the people who actually could use and to be connected with care and help, because still the majority of overdoses are male who are housed. And they're just stigmatized. A lot of them are in the trades, and that would love to access more people in there, because that's an education piece, a complex piece that needs to be addressed, because they don't want to tell their employers that they're using, because they do urine screens, or they're afraid to lose their jobs, basically, if they admit to it.
And I'm sorry, I came a little late this morning. You guys were on site and then were told to get off, or what happened?
Yes, yeah. With security and police, we're all here gathered. Said we cannot set up on Allen Health property because it is an unsanctioned site, but this is how overdose prevention sites started in Vancouver, in site. It was unsanctioned, but realized quickly how it was saving lives and giving people a place to turn to get care. And so we don't feel too badly about it. And we found a great spot. Look at it.
So you plan on having a doctor here? Is that the case?
Yeah, we have a doctor for all the shifts. So if there's any medical, so we also will help prevent any emergency visits, which are very costly. So even if people don't have any compassion in their hearts and think dollars, this is a good saving, life and cost saving measure. So there.
Dr. Eva Hemrick speaking Monday morning in front of an unsanctioned pop-up overdose prevention site near the North Island Hospital, Comox Valley. One of the harm reduction workers volunteering at the site gave members of the media a tour.
My name is Tasia. I'm a person with lived experience of substance use, opiates, and stimulants as well. Here supporting my prescribing doctor, the person that saved my life. Just wanted to show you that there are signs in the front here, rights and responsibilities. It's really important for everyone to feel safe, respected, treated with dignity, to be in a place, have respite, to be unharmed physically, emotionally, or psychologically, to be in a clean environment, to receive appropriate support and attention. And our responsibilities are just the same as those that are in hospital now, that everyone deserves a place to feel safe, including doctors, care aides, nurses, anyone that is responding to someone that may have substance use issues and also deserves to receive the health care that they have the right to. We all have a right to health care, and if it wasn't for physicians that took a stand and took a risk, I wouldn't be here, and that would be pretty devastating to my two kids. So now I get to be a great mom and live the life that I deserve to live because I received health care from brave doctors.
Tasia took myself and a few other members of the media inside the tent to show us how things were set up.
Some of the kits that we give are, so this would be like a for opiates, and what we include in them, we always give two of each, because the mandate is like never alone and never without naloxone. So the goal here is that someone is going to hopefully use with a friend, and to be witnessed so they don't die. And if anything happens to, you know, one piece, then they could use the other piece. Providing kits like this, it doesn't enable drug use. What it does is it reduces the risk of transmitting HIV, Hep C, communicable, and bloodborne diseases, and which are likely like one of the biggest costs in our healthcare system. So if we are encouraging people to, you know, everything new every time, then it reduces the traffic that happens in our emergency departments, which obviously we're all waiting 6 to 8 hours to see a doctor. Included in, I guess, our supplies, we have injection kits, and although every person might not utilize every single item in one of these bags, best practice is to provide everything new every time. And our kits sometimes will adapt just depending on the feedback that we get from folks that are using them.
So if I come in and I'm going to use this service, what happens? Can you walk me through?
So I think what I would do, I would, you know, ask your name if you're willing to share it. And if you're not, that's okay too. Usually introduce myself. You'll sit down. Is there anything that I can, you know, assist you with? And if I, having the education that I have, if I notice that someone might not be using a piece of the equipment correctly or safely, using, let's say, injection supplies, for example, there are certain areas on your body that you want to stay away from. And I've had a few times where someone was going to inject in a space that was not safe. And then when I've said to them, hey, did you know that these are the safest places to inject in your body? They had no idea that what they were doing was unsafe, and because it's what they're learning is on the street. It's kind of like when we're kids, and then either our parents are gonna tell us the truth or educate us, or we're gonna learn it from our buddies. So having that knowledge and then educating someone might change their route of administration. It might not. However, I can at least advise them on how to do something unsafe in the safest way. And yeah, how to take care of like before and after injecting, wound care and that sort of thing, and then signs to watch out for. You can, you know, socialize or not. I'm a pretty social person, so I end up getting like people talking typically, and then that's where the connection to services happen.
How's this helping you to be able to kind of pay it forward and help the other people?
It's everything to me. I lost my house, I lost my kids, I paid tens of thousands of dollars to go to treatment. I just got my kids back in my care December 1st, 2020. They are 10 and 11 years old, and a big part of me was lost for a long time, and being able to just notice one little thing about someone that might change their day and turn their life around, that's everything to me. Yeah, I support harm reduction and I advocate for treatment. There's room for both. Place like this, the conversation that's happening now is, it's so hard to watch because we can agree to disagree. And there's room for everybody at the table. You cannot access treatment if you are face down on the sidewalk because you have an unregulated supply of drugs, because you don't have access to wound care, because the hernia surgery that you just had, well, how do you get to hospital when you have a hernia? You don't. And when most services are offering like a bus pass or something, you're not going.
So I think that their harm reduction and recovery go hand in hand. So yeah, it's everything to me.
You're listening to People First Radio. On Monday, January 20th, members of a group called Doctors for Safer Drug Policy launched an unsanctioned pop-up overdose prevention site outside of the North Island Hospital, Comox Valley. The effort was led by Dr. Eva Hemrick, who runs the Village Clinic in Courtney. In November, Doctors for Safer Drug Policy opened two similar pop-up sites near hospitals in Nanaimo and Victoria. The group has been advocating for overdose prevention sites to be set up at hospitals on Vancouver Island. In a statement, Island Health said that their major hospital sites, including North Island Hospital, Comox Valley, have addictions medicine consult service teams embedded within them. It said that these teams, including specialized physicians, work closely with patients who use substances to develop unique and tailored care plans that meet the needs of patients, protect the safety of staff and other patients, and align with provincial policies and regulations. The statement said that the clinicians are focused on care planning that manages withdrawal symptoms related to substance use, with the goal of supporting patient comfort and reducing the need to use substances while admitted to hospital. The statement also said that Island Health welcomes continued dialogue with their partners on how they can work together to improve supports for people who use substances. It said that operating an unapproved clinical service or demonstration on Island Health property cannot be supported. The statement said that this position is not meant to dissuade advocacy, but rather to ensure that all services provided on Island Health property adhere to regulatory safety and clinical standards. The statement says that that is why Island Health Protection Services teams worked with organizers to ensure their planned activities did not occur on Island Health property. Finally, the statement said that organizers of the pop-up overdose prevention sites have been informed that using Island Health property for the purpose of any demonstration, protest, community event, or gathering without the express written consent and permission of Island Health is not permitted. On Monday, myself and other members of the media spoke with a number of people attending the setup of the site. On the next part of the program, we're going to bring you personal accounts of experience with substance use. Here's Heather Edward sharing part of her story.
I'm a recovering addict. I have 8 months clean, and in my addiction for 5 years, I was out on the streets, homeless, and I struggled coming to the hospital because I never had anywhere to use. So when we're on the streets, we get a lot of infections and stuff, and people are losing limbs, and they're procrastinating coming into the hospital because they can't use. They'll start withdrawing in like 4 to 5 hours, right? And people are dying going off site or even on site in the bathrooms and stuff, not having any supports in the hospital to get through their addiction. So in my case, I procrastinated coming to the hospital for infections and stuff because I was scared that I was going to withdraw or I would leave refusing care if I got the ambulance called on me for overdosing. I would refuse care because I would potentially withdraw in the hospital, and I couldn't do that. It's life threatening, right? When you get that far into your disease. So I could have been beneficial to me. It's hard on the healthcare system because then people are procrastinating in their care, and then they're coming to the hospital and needing a longer period of time to stay. And therefore that compromises the healthcare system because it could have just been an in and out visit, right, an antibiotic, and now they're having to extend their period of time, which is even harder on their health and their addiction, right? So in those cases it would have been beneficial, and it's just so people can properly get the care that they need out on the streets, right? So hopefully this is going to be beneficial to everyone out there.
Congratulations on your 5 months of sobriety.
Eight months. Yes.
That's awesome. That's a really good milestone.
Thank you.
She's going to be working in our clinics.
What's been the turning point for you?
Well, I just got to the point where I was done living the addiction, done being on the streets, and so many gifts of recovery have come along with it, right? Getting my family back. This was the first Christmas in 5 years I got to spend it with my kids. I'm getting a job at the doctor's office, the addictions clinic that I go to, and just so many gifts of recovery keep coming up. So, you know, my license and my family back in my life, and yeah, so I'm just, lots of positive things have come out of it. Yeah.
Callum Roth says he spent 20 years in addiction. Now he's working to help people going through that experience.
My name is Callum Roth. I'm a person with lived experience. I work at the Village Medical as a peer support worker. I also work at North Island Pharmacy as a driver for people with vulnerable medication needs for the OAT program, like methadone, Suboxone, and Cadian. So I shuttle people back and forth from a homeless shelter. I got these jobs because of my lived experience. I spent 20 years in addiction. The last five of them I spent down on the streets of Hastings as an intravenous drug user. Many attempts at trying to get sober. It did not happen overnight. I did not become addicted overnight. The drugs evolved a lot along the way. The big turning point for me, towards the end, I'd had enough suffering. I had to suffer. It's such a hard thing to say, but suffering. And then I got enough of the right supports in my corner. And then the day that I realized I didn't have a drug problem, that I had a Callum problem, and the drugs were the solution to my problem, was the day I was really able to start to do the underlining work on Callum. And that's the truth. There is so much more to it than me just not doing the drugs. I have to do the underlining work. And if I just put the drugs down, that's not enough to keep me sober. There is so much more to it than just not doing the drugs. Like I said, the drugs weren't the problem. They were actually the solution.
You mentioned there that you had some supports in place. Once you had the right supports in place, could you tell me more about what those were?
There's some amazing supports downtown Vancouver. It started right off in the hospital. Like, I don't know how many support workers, when it comes to referrals, intakes, restarts with methadone doctors, getting into medical detoxes, treatment centers, all of these things require quite the process and a lot of medical people to help you get there. And I'm guessing there had to have been well over 10,000 people to get me here sober today, easily, in the province of British Columbia, after doing 19 treatment centers, well over 15 medical detoxes. I've been hospitalized well over a dozen times. I've had kidney failure, I've had spinal cord injuries, I've had several infections, pneumonia. So after all those visits and all that health care and all that money that's been, thank God somebody did it, because I wouldn't have been able to do it myself, but all that time has been put into just trying to get me sober for one day. It's because of those resources that were in place that allowed me to get here. But what we need is more resources, and definitely these rural communities. I was in Vancouver, where they had lots of resources. Then I moved here, where we didn't have all the resources, and we seem to be a little behind the times. So we need to catch up. That's what we're here for, yeah, being part of that solution.
Yeah, can you tell me maybe more about, like, what's happening here today? Like, what do you hope, what do you think people need to know about it, and what do you hope comes out of it?
I believe, coming from the life that I live, the best thing that can help people is education. I did not have much education, especially on the drugs that I was consuming. They changed so fast along the way. I was a heroin addict, and I did not ask for fentanyl to get put into my heroin. And then I did not ask for benzodiazepam to get put into my fentanyl, right? These are decisions that got taken away from me as an addict, but I had no choice. I was in the culture, and it wasn't like it was just one dealer this happened to. It happened to all the dealers simultaneously, where this is all I could get was this toxic drug supply. I had no other options. I've done many different programs with OAT, safe injection OAT, methadone sites. There's fentanyl patch programs, Ventura programs. Suboxone, Cadian, there's so many different options. I've tried them all. Not all of them work for me, but finding the right mixture and the right team and the right supports, I highly recommend therapy. AA, Narcotics Anonymous, has been a huge support in my life. I have an amazing family behind me. I have an amazing addictions team behind me, and I've got an amazing mental health team. I've actually got two different teams for that. I have to keep them separated. So there's a lot of resources for us to learn to lean on. We just need to learn where those resources are.
Sometimes I feel like people in the media talk about, like, treatment as a, like, a catch-all term. From your experience, is there anything you think, like, people need to know about when we talk about treatment for addiction or substance use, like what that actually looks like and what that process is, can be like?
Absolutely. So the one thing you need to know, there is no cure to this disease. So going to treatment doesn't mean by the time I come out the other side, I'm not going to be a drug addict. I am going to be a drug addict and have the disease of addiction for the rest of my life. Today I'm in remission, right? I look at it like it's cancer. So treatment centers are really good and they're really safe and they put us in a bubble where we can start learning the tools and start working on that underlying problem that is Callum, not the drugs. We remove the drugs, we give myself a safe place to be, but at the same time, if I do something wrong or I make somebody feel uncomfortable and I've been asked to leave 18 out of the 19 treatment centers I went to, partially A, because I wasn't ready, but B, I don't get to ask why I have to leave. They just say leave. You don't get to defend yourself why. We have literally pretty much zero rights as addicts for the first 5 years of our recovery if we're living within our supportive community. Because we're in supportive housing or second stage housing or recovery housing or the treatment center, we don't get to ask why. We just have to do what they say, and if we break any rule, we gotta go and we're right back to where we started. And we have to go right through that whole process of asking permission to go get the help, waiting the 6 to 8 weeks to get into a medical detox, then going to a treatment center again. It turns the process into a very overwhelming process to do 19, 20 times as an addict. And by the end of it, we start losing steam. It's almost like insanity. You keep doing the same thing over and over again, like addiction, expecting a different result. But when we keep trying to get clean, we're expecting a different result. We keep failing. We start to think it's insane to quit. We start to think quitting isn't the answer, and we give up on our system, we give up on ourselves. But the truth is, we have to just keep trying.
You were talking a little bit earlier about maybe some of the differences between Vancouver and the Comox Valley in the services. And you were also talking about some of the work that you do here. Can you tell me about maybe like the impact you've seen from that work?
It's been beautiful. In the last almost, it's been 2 years since I started working at the addictions clinic. I've seen just shy of 50 people come off the Connect parking lot and they're sober and fighting for their lives. Some of those people are here in this crowd today. Many of them have already taken 1 year cakes, which is like a milestone that we celebrate, which is a big one for us. We got a whole lot of them coming up on 2 years. We got a lot of people collecting time and fighting for their lives. And not many people get to hear about the people who are coming out of the homeless shelters and finding their lives, getting married and becoming members of this community. And what we're all learning is that after we come out of this fire, we need to grab a jug of water and go back to pull someone else out. And that's kind of the solution. One fentanyl addict helping another fentanyl addict, because that seems to be the recipe that's working really well today.
Is there anything I haven't asked about or we haven't talked about that you think it's important to share with people?
No, I think we've touched on it all. I think the biggest thing is we need to educate people more about the disease and try to break down stigma. It's so important that people know that this isn't my choice and that it wasn't always my choice when I was bent over staring at the concrete unconscious and people thinking I was dead. If I really wanted to quit that day, I had to wait in line with a whole lot of other people to get the help. So I just want to get the information out there that like it's not all a choice, it is a disease for sure.
Thank you so much for speaking.
How would you ask or suggest that people do that and educate themselves?
Oh man, this is something that me and my whole family had to learn the hardest way possible with trial and error. I support reaching out, I hate saying Google because Google is really hard to find. When it comes to individual communities, every community you need to tap into some community members and start asking and seeking out the resources. They're vast and wide, but it's a lot easier to learn. I learned on the fly. So like for people who want to learn, I say stop by our clinic at the Village, and we love to educate people and we love to show them direction. Whether you don't even want to get clean and you just want to survive this disease in a healthier way until you're ready to fight for your life, like there's treating addiction, and it's not all necessarily about abstinence either, right? There's so many ways to treat. So yeah, come see us. I'd love to educate as many people as we can. I want to get the word out there. I'm just not sure how to do that yet.
Callum Roth speaking about some of his experiences with addiction and his work helping others through it. This was on Monday, January 20th, near a pop-up overdose prevention site outside the North Island Hospital, Comox Valley.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Also in attendance on Monday were parents of people with experience of addiction.
I spoke with one of them. Can you tell me a little bit about your story and what brings you here to the Comox Valley Hospital today?
My son called last week and told us this was going on, and they wanted family support so people understand that it's, you don't leave an addict out on the street. It's, and 100%, I feel and reach out to the parents of addicts, because it's not the parents' fault. They blame themselves. They think that he's doing it because of us, and it's not true. It's they chose their path, and they're living in their path.
Could you tell me maybe a bit about that journey of yours as a parent? Like, what was it like?
Oh, in the beginning, we were in denial, and we just sort of stayed away from it. And then as it got worse and worse, and we had him home, we tried to get him clean, we got him into recovery centers, we did all the route, and the time just went by, and all of a sudden, 5 years as an addict turns into 10 years as an addict, and then 10 years turns into 15, and next thing you know, how do you help your children? We had to come to the terms that one day we were probably going to bury our kids. I had two sons that were in active addiction. And you had to come to the terms that one day you were going to bury your own children. And once I came to those terms and explained to the two boys that if they're going to use, they can't come home. They both got clean about 3 months after Christmas. They've been clean for about 6 months. They stayed in active addiction. When we told them they couldn't come home for Christmas, they started getting clean about 3 months later. And they both had to get clean through hospital programs and treatment centers, and the support staff that my son has here with the doctors is an absolutely amazing relationship, to watch these doctors who are doing this so they can make a difference with the people that need difference made.
Can you tell me about this service and maybe how you view it as a parent, what you would want other people who don't feel like they have a connection to this issue, what you would want them to know about this service?
There's a sign here that one of the people are saying, and it describes this almost perfectly: empathy versus stigma. Because that's what it is. People see addicts and they think they're just losers. They don't realize that they have a family. Lots of them have children. Lots of them have had jobs and they can't work now, and they're living on the streets and all of this stuff. They're just the empathy. You have to reach out to these people. You have to, they ask you for money on the side of the street. You, instead of putting your head down, you don't have to give them money. Just talk to them. Just connect with them. Find out their story. The more we get the story out there, the sooner we're going to be able to come up with a solution.
You talked a little earlier about this decision that your family had to make of like setting this very difficult boundary of saying like you couldn't come home for Christmas while you were in active addiction. If some people were to take a look at a service like this, and there have been comments that would describe a service like this as something like enabling, what would you say to people who would take that view?
So what if we're enabling? We're getting them off the street. We're trying to help somebody. These drugs are killing our children. Stand and watch and watch your kids come next. Or do you actually get to know them and deal with them? It's you don't stop loving your kid just because he's doing drugs, right? You don't stop loving your kid because he goes to prison. You don't stop loving your kid because he shoplifts to live.
And you were telling me before we started recording this that you have a couple of weddings you're looking forward to going to.
Both my boys have been clean for over 2 years, and both of them are getting married this year.
This is People First Radio. If you're just tuning in, we've been sharing moments from the launch of an unsanctioned pop-up overdose prevention site just outside of the North Island Hospital, Comox Valley. It took place on Monday, January 20th. The site was organized by the group Doctors for Safer Drug Policy, a group of Vancouver Island physicians who are calling for overdose prevention sites to be opened at hospitals across the island. Here is some statistical information about unregulated drug deaths in British Columbia. It comes from the BC Coroner Service's most recent update, provided in December 2024. The data runs through October of last year. That month, there were 5 unregulated drug deaths a day in the province. 70% of those dying were between 30 and 59 years old. 74% were male. From January through October 2024, 81% of drug deaths occurred indoors. 48% of the total occurred in private residences. 31% occurred in other indoor locations, such as social and supportive housing, SROs, and hotel rooms, among other indoor spaces. 19% of deaths occurred outside. Dr. Eva Hemrick, who runs the Village Clinic in Courtney, was the media contact and lead organizer of this pop-up overdose prevention site outside the North Island Hospital. I reached her on Wednesday for an update on how things were going.
Day one was both exciting and slightly concerning, having had, 12 security persons on property and then also RCMP. But they were very cooperative, and we found a great spot, as you probably saw. And we've been there, and it was overwhelmingly positive feedback from drivers by honking their horns, and people coming by too. So it felt very supported and hopeful, actually, in that the public seemed to support what we're doing and see the need. We've had a couple of, interactions with people of opposite opinion, but it's led to good discussion and hopefully information sharing. We've had a few people use the site, and now that the word has come out, there's more patients that are aware that we are there, and they can come to use the site as well.
What do you think it's important people know as we go forward through the rest of this week and even beyond when you had planned to be there?
I think for people to take the time and learn the reasons why this is important, and hopefully support it, which most of them seem to do, but learn more about it and learn about addiction and withdrawal, and also that this is leading to unnecessary deaths, and addictions can happen to anyone. And in fact, this is a reminder that the average person who dies of fentanyl use is a male, is housed, working in the trades. That it could be anyone. It could be your son, your uncle, your co-worker, whatnot. So really, we're trying to educate and open people's minds and hearts to dissolve stigma so that people will look to help, so they don't feel ashamed to get help for their substance use.
You're a doctor working in addictions medicine. Where would you recommend, when you say your hope is that people would educate themselves about addiction and about this issue, how would you recommend that they do that?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I think there is a lot online, for sure. People reach a lot of information online. Within Island Health, there's a lot of information, actually, on substance use mental health. But if one-on-one, they want to go and see somebody, certainly we're open here at the clinic and have peers, and we can, if people have specific concerns, otherwise it would be the mental health and substance use unit. There's a change. It changed a little bit that we now have a addiction medicine fraction of mental health and substance use. It's changed a bit, but regardless, on England Avenue, in our community, there is a mental health and substance use office where people can go in and talk to somebody and get advice. There is also AVI, AIDS and Coral on 6th Street, which is open 7 days a week, and the nurses and staff are happy to help educate people about these substances. I do think we need more interviews with people with lived experience, more of this in the press, and really appreciate you covering this. The more people know, the more they understand and the more compassion, and also help problem solve, that we are all in this together. We have a common, unfortunately, a huge problem. Everybody needs to do their piece.
Dr. Hemrick, thank you so much for taking the time to give me this update.
Yeah, thank you so much for covering this very important story.
Dr. Eva Hemrick specializes in addiction medicine and runs the Village Clinic in Courtney. She was involved in setting up an unsanctioned pop-up overdose prevention site outside the North Island Hospital, Comox Valley, the week of Monday, January 20th.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
BC's Human Rights Commissioner has a book club. There are no formal meetings. Anyone interested in learning more about human rights is encouraged to take part at their own pace. Each month, there are two books, one for adults and one for kids. This month's books are On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century by Timothy Snyder, and The Little Hummingbird by Michael Nicol Yagoulanis. I got in touch with BC's Human Rights Commissioner to do one of my favorite things, talk about books.
My name is Kasari Govender. I'm BC's Human Rights Commissioner. I go by she, her pronouns. I'm joining today from unceded Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh territory in what's now known as Vancouver. I am an independent officer of the legislature, which means that I'm not appointed by government of the day, whoever the political sort of parties are who hold power at the time. I'm appointed in a nonpartisan way to provide independent kind of oversight, watchdog kind of role on human rights in the province. And that means that I don't resolve individual complaints of discrimination. So if somebody feels that they've been discriminated against, it's contrary to the human rights code, there's another place for them to go. That's the Human Rights Tribunal. My work and our work of as an office is to try to tackle systems, prevent human rights abuses from arising in the first place through tools like education, law reform, going to court, that kind of thing.
And one maybe new tool in your toolbox is a book club of all things. Can you tell me about where the idea for that came?
Yeah, so, you know, for me, the book club is really an education initiative. It's about, you know, I think of our education work as about changing hearts and minds. And I think, what better way to do that through the power of story and words? You know, our listeners today can't see where we're both sitting, but both of us are sitting in books full of rooms. Rooms full of books, sorry. Reverse that. And so I think it speaks to the power of books that they have in stories, again, that have in our lives, from the times we're very young throughout our lifespan. And so, you know, when I think about the role of reading in my life, it has certainly been a tool of learning, also a tool not just of kind of academic learning or school-based learning, but the kind of learning that brings you into somebody's experience and somebody's story. And that's so important, I think, for us to bring that empathy-based learning to our exploration of human rights. This is how we can bridge these big divides that we find in our society by building our emotional connections and building empathy.
I want to dive more into that, and maybe the best way to do it is to get a little specific and put maybe a book to this concept. This week, or this month, the book you've chosen for the club is called On Tyranny. Could you explain a little bit about why this one?
Yeah, for sure. So this is the second of the books that we've released. We had started this last month. And this month, I think, is really, it is really about tackling some of the big themes in our society, some of the big worries that we see around us, the attacks on democracy that we see close to home and around the world, the rise of authoritarian or at least populist governments. And I think that's a scary place to be. So one of the themes somewhat inadvertently that emerged from this month's books, and actually there are two because we have an adult book club and a children's book club, and both the books this month, including On Tyranny, talk about, they're kind of calls to action, and they're, in my mind, calls to action that provide hope. So we see these big scary things happening around us. I think for many of us are worried about the state of the world. And these books provide us with a way forward. They provide us with some answers about how do I join with others to make a difference? How can I, as one person in this big world, make a difference? And how can I join with others to make a difference? So that's why this book seems so right for now, in this moment of time, in time.
And perhaps in particular, this month, if you read through the book, a lot of the content might be really at the forefront of people's minds. When did you choose that, you know, this would be the book for January?
We chose a couple of months ago, and it is an American author for this one. We've certainly tried to pick some Canadian authors as well, but this one is an American author. And, I think certainly is many of us are reflecting again what's happening south of the border. And I think it's important for those conversations, and again, not to feel totally powerless in the face of, one of our, the significant human rights issues that are happening under the new administration in the U.S. So feels very relevant. And if I can just slip in there, you're probably going to ask me about the children's book, but if I can say that the children's book that we launched this month is called The Little Hummingbird. And it's about this tiny little creature who is trying to tackle a raging forest fire. And drop by drop, she brings water to try to put out the forest fire. And all the other animals are kind of cowering and they're scared. Of course, this is a big raging forest fire. And the bear asks her, "What are you doing?" And the little hummingbird says, "I'm doing the best I can." And I think that's also a beautiful companion piece to these big overwhelming issues. You know, we need to do the best we can. And on tyranny, the book on tyranny by Timothy Snyder, the adult book, provides us with somewhat of a blueprint of how to do that.
And that blueprint is something that someone could get through relatively quickly, probably like in less than 2 hours. The book is made up of these 20 kind of bite-sized chapters. Each one has a theme like stand out or be kind to our language, contribute to good causes, things like that. When you read through this, were there any of them in particular that stood out or stuck with you?
Yeah, absolutely. There's one of his lessons is around believing in truth. And his point here, I think, is about believing even in the concept that there is such a thing as what is true. And this really speaks to me. He says, to abandon facts is to abandon freedom. If nothing is true, then no one can criticize power because there is no basis upon which to do so. If nothing is true, then all is spectacle. The biggest wallet pays for the most blinding lights. That one to me is really resonates now and really through my whole time in this role as Human Rights Commissioner. I came into this role wanting to work on issues related to hate and the rise of white supremacy around the world and closer to home. And then I started about 6 months before the pandemic hit. And so when the pandemic hit, we saw this skyrocketing rates of hate incidents around our province, really within our communities. And we announced and then launched an inquiry into the rise of hate during COVID. It took us a couple of years. We talked to thousands of British Columbians. We ended up producing a 400 plus page report. And one of the pieces that emerged from that was the role of mis and disinformation in driving hate in our communities. And so this notion of what is true and believing that there is such a thing as truth and that we can fact check, that we can come up to a shared understanding of what is true in our world is so important, I think, to living in peace and living in harmony with each other.
Have you been following that thread and how it's evolved since maybe the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic? Has kind of that rise in hate, though? What has happened to it?
It's been a really still going, I could say it really simply. There are many hate incidents happening around us, and the rates continue to be significant across the province. They're often correlated with events in kind of the geopolitical world. So, for example, of course, what happened in Gaza and Israel has led to, as we know, a rise in anti-Palestinian sentiment, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia. We know that there have been, you know, a series of marches across the country to protest SOGI curriculum or materials in schools that deal with gender identity and sexual orientation. That those marches led to an increase in hate against trans communities in particular. So we see this correlation and these spikes of hate continue. And again, I think we see the role that mis and disinformation play in that. So we've seen over the last couple of weeks some key announcements from social media companies about how, you know, Meta is no longer fact-checking. Insofar as their fact-checking was effective, you know, it was at least one protective mechanism in place so that we weren't constantly spreading to each other across our communities wrong information that can inflame this hyperpolarization that we find ourselves in.
Of course, already in Canada for the last couple of years, news articles were blocked on Meta platforms, speaking of sharing information on the internet. Is there anything else you think it's important to highlight about either the club, this month's books, or just how people can keep this going once our conversation ends today?
Well, I just really encourage you to follow us on social media if you haven't, just keep an eye on our website, visit your local library. We'd love you to read along with us and hopefully discover new themes as we go. Our hope is that this year we'll be successful in generating momentum around this. We'll be able to keep releasing books. Of course, 12 months doesn't give us enough time to explore nearly as many themes as we'd like to. So this is just a selection, but I really hope that you read along with us and enjoy this journey. For me, these sections have been deeply personal. They're all books that have made a difference for me and for my family and having these conversations. I hope you find them useful as well, and I hope you're motivated to read along.
Kasari Govender is BC's Human Rights Commissioner. That is it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.